Welcome back to the High Tech Forum podcast. I'm Richard Bennett, and our guest today is Commissioner Ajit Pai of the FCC. This is kind of a special treat, the first FCC commissioner we've had on the High Tech Forum podcast series. So welcome, Commissioner Pai.
Hey, Richard. It's great to be with you. Thanks for having me on.
Thanks for agreeing to do it. So let me, you got a really impressive stellar resume, one might say. Attended Harvard Law School, attended Harvard along with L. Franken, right?
Yeah, that's right. Not at the same time, but yeah.
went to the University of Chicago Law School, clerked in the Eastern District of Louisiana before moving to the Justice Department's Antitrust Division, where you worked on the Telecommunications Task Force, pretty good background. You left Justice to be Associate General Counsel at Verizon in 2001, where you handled competition matters and that sort of thing. And then went back to, then you went to the Senate Judiciary Committee, Subcommittee on Administrative Oversight in the Courts, and then returned to Justice as Senior Counsel in the Office of Legal Policy in 2004, held that position until 2005. When you were hired as chief counsel of the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Property Rights, so back to Capitol Hill. Between 2007 and 2011, you held several positions in the FCC's Office of General Counsel, most prominently as Deputy General Counsel. And in 2010, you won the Marshall Memorial Fellowship Leadership Development Initiative. And then went to the law firm of Jenner and Block, where you were a partner. And mysteriously, Republicans were able to recruit you to leave that partnership behind and join the FCC as one of the minority commissioners appointed by President Obama in 2011. And you were sworn in 2012. So... I hope you're having fun at the FCC.
Oh, it's been a great job. I've had a number of them, as you pointed out. My mom would tell you I can't keep a job for more than 2 years, but this one has been just terrific for anyone who loves this field, who's intellectually curious, and who enjoys interacting with people and speaking and writing about what he or she believes. This is the best place to be.
Yeah, I think a lot of people envy your job, actually. So the FCC has some curious sunshine rules that prevent us from talking about certain issues that are, I thought sunshine laws were supposed to be about transparency, but what are some of the issues that we can't talk about today?
Unfortunately, we probably can't talk about the so-called set-top box proceeding since the chairman has decided to keep the sunshine rules in place. And so for your listeners, that effectively means that I cannot discuss with anyone in the public unless I proactively solicit views clarifying views. I can't have any conversation with a member of the public about that proceeding, but I can reiterate what I've said before, though, which is that, number one, I do think the chairman should make that proposal public, and number two, that we should embrace where the marketplace is going as opposed to where it was 20 years ago. But that's really the only one I can think of where it's sort of a third rail from a procedural perspective.
Okay, so we could talk about the privacy and PRM.
Oh, definitely,
okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, the curious thing, I mean, I'll just extemporize then on the set-top box proceeding is that it seems that we're converging on a solution, except for some of the details, which are still pretty contentious, which is pretty much where the industry was going before the FCC started the inquiry.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah, which kind of reinforces one of the saws about Washington. It's not so much what gets done, it's who gets credit for it.
Right.
Yeah.
That's exactly right. So I'm hopeful that we can return to the consensus solution that the MVPDs put forward a few months ago. But the devil's going to be in the details. And right now, the details are still secret.
Mm-hmm. On the privacy proceeding, there's some scuttlebutt in the media that the commission is moving back or is moving toward a position where the choice architecture in the privacy NPRM, which is to say the defaults, for opt-in and opt-out. I wrote a blog post on High Tech Forum about that last Thursday. And they're moving to the position where they want to align the choice architecture with the Federal Trade Commission.
Right.
If that's the case, that'd be a very productive development, right?
It would be. I mean, we haven't seen any paper yet, but we've been hearing rumors that that might be the case. And that would be terrific. I mean, I think there are any number of reasons why they might be moving in that direction. One, of course, would be political. It's rare to see a sister agency criticizing the FCC. But in this case, the FTC said that the chairman's proposal was not optimal, that it wouldn't protect consumers and didn't reflect how the marketplace operated. So that might be one reason why they're trying to harmonize the FCC's privacy regs with those of the FTC's. The other one might be technical, too. I mean, I would like to think that if you look at the record, you see a number of internet service providers and others say that, you know, we don't have unique insight into broadband consumers' behavior, you know, given the use of encrypted internet traffic, given the fact that any given mobile user, for example, might traverse a number of different ISPs networks. You know, the edge providers actually are the dominant players in online advertising, not us. And so, you know, hopefully this adjustment, if it turns out to be an adjustment, reflects a more carefully calibrated view of how the internet actually operates and how it's used.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point, because the I've heard two arguments for dissimilar choice architectures between the edge services and carriers. One of them that everything that the edge that the carriers have access to is sensitive, because they can't tell if it's sensitive or not unless they look at it. And looking at it means that they're looking at the sensitive data. But since Harold Feld made that in a made that argument in a discussion we had in the Russell Building last Tuesday, which it seems to me it's a bit disingenuous, because it's an algorithm that looks at it.
Exactly.
And as long as you're not retaining the information that the algorithm looks at, I mean, nobody's the wiser. And, yeah. Of course, the other one is that position argument. But, you know, they're in a position where they get to look at a lot of encrypted data. And because right. they don't have, you know, NSA-type code-breaking capability or any reason to invest in that, they don't, the physical location is much less important than the ability to see the information, which they don't have.
Exactly right. And I've heard, and you probably know better than I, but upward of 75 to 80% of all traffic is now encrypted, and that any given ISP can't know other than you know, the basic domain, mm-hmm. What exactly the consumer is accessing.
Yeah, and the only real hang-up on encrypting the data from the very beginning of the internet was that we didn't have enough CPU power to do it. But CPU power is so cheap now, and there's so much excess CPU power actually in most of the processors that people have in their home machines and in their data center machines, that it's a fairly trivial thing to encrypt.
Right.
So it's just, you know, why wouldn't you do it? I mean, it's not necessarily because you're trying to shield your data from your ISP. It's like you're trying to shield the data from everyone else that might be a malicious, from the genuine malicious actors, trade secrets and company confidentials. And maybe, you know, you have a former spouse who has a grudge or a disgruntled former employee or whatever. I mean, there are lots of reasons to secure data. It's a good practice in general.
And actually, that concern reminds me of something else, which I think has had some resonance here, at least I'd like to think it has, which is that the entire question is, what is the consumer's perspective on this? And from the consumer perspective, you don't care whether or not it's an internet service provider or an edge provider or an outside malicious actor or whoever. You want your data protected if it's sensitive. And so having this sort of bifurcated, okay, we're going to treat ISPs one way and edge providers another, it doesn't seem to me makes a lot of analytical sense if mm-hmm. what we're after is promoting consumer welfare.
Well, I think from the consumer perspective, it just adds to the confusion and the uncertainty. Because, you know, I don't think the typical consumer is really keenly aware of things like BGP and, you know, TLS and how the internet works. I mean, it really became obvious in some of the discussion around the ICANN transition that there are a lot of people who think ICANN is something like AOL.
Right.
That, you know, all your data goes through them and they can control, you know, free speech. And they really don't have that power. The internet's a decentralized distributed system.
Right.
So Another sort of bizarre political event took place last Friday in the Senate when the minority leader, Senator Reid, did what he could to hold up Senator Thune's spectrum bill in retaliation for the refusal of the Senate Democrats to reconfirm Commissioner Rosenworcel's second term. And, you know, she's an extremely popular commissioner, I think, with both sides. And the only, you know, the only reason to hold up her reconfirmation was Chairman Wheeler's refusal to promise to follow tradition and step down. Do you see that issue getting resolved, or is that not on your radar?
I've certainly read a lot about it in the press, but the particular discussions surrounding it on Capitol Hill, I haven't been privy to, so I'm not sure what conversations Chairman Wheeler might have had with the Senate, or what conversations anyone has had with Commissioner Rosenworcel about it. But what I can say is that I really hope that Senator Thune's legislation, the Mobile Now bill that you referenced, I really hope it moves forward, because putting the reconfirmation, the personnel questions to the side, this is a really good bipartisan solution that I think would move the ball substantially forward on one of the most critical areas within the FCC's bailiwick, which is spectrum policy. And here I think it's a chance for us to really show leadership, national leadership, in the area of spectrum. And that's something that I would hope that doesn't come with a partisan affiliation attached to it. So, yeah, I might be the foolish optimist, but I hope that however the personnel questions resolve themselves, that this legislation gets passed and passed soon.
Well, it jeopardizes, if we don't pass that legislation, the U.S. leadership in 5G, becomes questionable at some point.
Absolutely right. And one of the things I have noticed in talking to some of my counterparts abroad is that they're very eager to push the envelope as quickly as they can in order to to take the mantle, so to speak, of 5G leadership. And you know as well as I do that this is not we don't operate in a vacuum. If if another country is more forward thinking, then the innovation and investment is going to flow elsewhere.
Yeah, and some of our rivals, we have, it's sort of global politics is kind of like Silicon Valley. You compete and then with your friends.
Right.
And some of the countries that, the U.S. was the unquestioned leader in the wide-scale deployment of 4G LTE. And that hurt some feelings around the world. And other countries, who really see themselves as great tech innovators, like East Asia and the European Union in particular. I mean, European Union was a real leader in the 2G era of mobile communications, but they've kind of fallen by the wayside, I think, because the regulatory approach is a bit too prescriptive.
Absolutely right. It's funny you mentioned that. I remember when I first got into this field in the late 90s, early 2000s, hearing that some folks in the European Union thought, oh, here are the Americans saddled with this crazy patchwork of CDMA and TDMA and GSM, and how are they going to work it all out? And meanwhile, we Europe are just really leading the way on wireless, and just half a generation later, here we are, and we've got 50% or so of the world's 4G LTE subscriptions. It's remarkable.
It's a substantial number. I don't know what it is today, but it kind of helps when you have Qualcomm in your country.
Right. That's right. Exactly. Yeah. Now, that's the kind of I really do hope that we continue to see that kind of leadership in the 5G world. I don't know, just not to be parochial, but I do think that there's a culture of innovation here that would really bear some benefits for consumers if it were allowed to flourish fully.
Yeah, whenever I do policy events in Europe, it inevitably at some point, maybe over lunch or at the reception, I'll be asked the question of why is it that Europe can't innovate the way the United States can? And it seems from the U.S. perspective, it's fairly straightforward in that, we have a legal regime that permits a lot of experimentation, and we have a financial system in which failure is not necessarily punished. And, folks in Silicon Valley will tell you they learn more from their failures than they do from their successes. And, of course, my little flip answer used to be because you don't have Steve Jobs. But can't say that anymore. But yeah, so now I guess it's they don't have Qualcomm.
Right. It's funny. A good friend of mine who is in the Bay Area, an entrepreneur, started and sold many companies. He's from France originally. And so I asked him about this very question. And you know, I thought he was going to say, oh, you know, the regulatory framework or, you know, the broadband infrastructure is better here. But he said, you know, don't underestimate the power of culture, because amongst his friends, he was consistently seen as this sort of black sheep who's always thinking about the outside of the box with these crazy ideas. And you know, in France, that was seen as a bad thing. You know, you need to have a stable job that you could stay at for 20, 30 years. Whereas here in Silicon Valley, and this is very much his it very much fit his way of thinking. And that's the reason why I'd like to think we see these startups grow into, you know, the next Uber or the next Airbnb is you know, we do have a culture of letting people succeed and fail on the merits.
Well, you know, in Silicon Valley, the joke is the people who do startups are the ones who can't hold a job.
Right. Yeah, sadly, that hasn't been proven to be the case in my own situation. But yeah,
you're quite young yet. I mean, this career that I outlined is like, what, 13, 14 years? I mean,
Well, you're very kind, but I just think back. You know, for example, one of my friends who I was in the same dorm with in college, he was the first employee at Google, and I sometimes wonder, like, oh, what if I just followed him out to Silicon Valley? And you never know; I could be retired right now, sitting on a yacht, I suppose. But no, I'm not complaining about how things turned out.
Yeah, I've got a story like that too. I used to work for the guy who started Compaq.
Oh, really?
Wow. And he wanted me to come to work for Compaq, and it was like I was living in Austin, Texas, and I didn't want to move to Houston.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, he owns a mountain in Aspen now.
Really? Wow.
Yeah, he's got his own private mountain.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah, so I get to drive by there. I was really, really thrilled by the House passage of their Comact update. Comact update is something that the Energy and Commerce Committee has been working on for what, 2 or 3 years now. I mean, they've had several rounds of, you know, of comment cycles where they ask questions to the, sort of like an FCC proceeding in a way. They ask questions to the public, took comments, worked those into a draft, and at the end of the day, they came up with a list of 8 discrete pieces of legislation that were all passed essentially. I mean, there were maybe 1 or 2 votes against some of them, but for the most part, they passed the House unanimously.
Exactly. And that's a remarkable feat in this polarized environment. And just given the breadth of some of the topics, too, I mean, as you know, they covered everything from anti-spoofing legislation to Carey's Law Act, which promotes direct access to 911, to rural call completion, to, as you said, substantive reforms of the Communications Act. And the committee has done a tremendous job, the House Energy and Commerce Committee, advancing this legislation. And this is another one of the bills that I would hope the Senate would take seriously over the next couple of months.
Well, I'd really hate to see something like that, which is such a landmark of bipartisan cooperation. And it's really sort of returning to the tradition of the way telecom policy used to be like this, apparently, in Washington before I started hanging out there, that it was mostly, you know, nonpartisan stuff. I mean, there were some differences of emphasis, obviously, between the members of Congress who represented urban areas and those in the rural areas, because they're completely different financial structure that you have to really make broadband available to the rural people. But, you know, on things like, we want an open internet. Sure, we all want an open internet. The dispute's about how we get it.
Right.
Yeah.
That is one of the sad things to me about telecom policy. As I said, when I first came to Washington, I remember going to a hearing, and I think it was 2000 or 2001, and honestly, I mean, if you just put a bag over your head and listen to the questions, you wouldn't know whether the questioner was a Republican or a Democrat. You'd see people on both sides of the aisle taking different kinds of positions. And I think it's only in recent years it's become much more politicized. And that's really for a sector that's so critical to our economy and where there are no obvious partisan slants, I don't think, to things like broadband deployment or spectrum policy. It's really unfortunate that it's become a, you know, my camp versus yours, I'm right and you're wrong kind of environment. But you know, that's I guess, the symptom of the ages in which we live. But
well, yeah, I mean, it's almost like bubblegum is a partisan issue, I guess. You know, what, you know, do you have what brand you chew, or if you chew it at all?
Yeah.
So the package of 8 bills, the one that grabbed my attention most keenly was the FCC process reform bill.
Yeah.
And I wonder if we might take a second just to go through some of the provisions. It's I looked at the text of the bill, and it one of the things that's really outstanding is that it would allow a bipartisan majority of commissioners to place something on the agenda for the open meeting, which is a departure from current practice where only the chairman can place items on the agenda. So even if all four of the commissioners agree on something, if the chairman doesn't like it, it doesn't fly. That really goes a long way, I think, toward establishing a bipartisan or a nonpartisan atmosphere in the FCC, wouldn't it?
I think so. And as you know, some of our sister agencies currently have this power, and it's worked really well, I think, for the American public. One of my friends, the former commissioner Josh Wright over at the Federal Trade Commission, for instance, he was an advocate for reforming the FTC's interpretation of its Section 5 authority, its unfair trade practices authority. Mm-hmm. And working with two of his fellow Democrats over at the FTC, he managed to force onto the agenda this particular reform, and it ended up passing with an overwhelming 4-1 vote. And you know, that's the kind of thing, obviously, as a minority commissioner, I would like. But I think it's ultimately a good way to check the power of any person who might be the chief executive of an agency. You know, a CEO should not mean that you get to dictate everything that the agency decides. And you know, if there's a good idea that three or more commissioners like, well, let's put it on the agenda and hash it out over a vote. That's the way it should be done, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, and when the chairman has this power, he doesn't even have to wield it in order to bring people to heel. I mean, it's simply the threat that he could keep up, you know, say, just this didn't happen. But for example, if Chairman Wheeler had a problem with Commissioner Clyburn, he could have kept the prison phone item off the agenda and, you know, in order to get her to accede on something else. And again, I'm not saying that happened. It didn't happen. But, right. You know, that sort of arm twisting would be necessary or is, you know, really possible under the current regime. And I think that pretty well goes away with this provision. And the other thing that I think is something I know that you've commented on a whole lot. It's about publishing the text of agenda items before they're voted on.
Yeah.
I mean, I think if people who don't follow the FCC extremely closely would probably be astonished to learn that in the typical case, especially on a high-profile item like the Title II reclassification, when the vote is taken, commissioners literally do not know what's in the bill. I mean, they don't know the details of the regulation. So it's not like when Nancy Pelosi made the joke about we have to pass the bill to see what's in it. I mean, because they actually have the full text of the bill before them. It's just that, you know, they don't have time to read 5,000 pages worth of budget language and then find the little secret gotcha in the middle of it somewhere. With editorial privileges, which is something that your colleague, Commissioner O'Reilly, has complained about sort of perpetually and for good reason, you literally, the text can change between the time the vote is taken and when the item is published.
Absolutely right, yeah. And even making all of that worse is the American public has no idea at all about what it is we're voting on, other than you know, the chairman's office's own self-serving fact sheet if they choose to put one out, or misleading press releases or press statements they put out there, which all too often are completely inaccurate. And so, you know, people like me are put in a catch-22. Either we just stay silent and, you know, vote and do the inside game, so to speak, in terms of dissenting or you're trying to get changes to the order, or we try to, you know, put our own spin out there, and we get accused by the majority, the chairman's office in particular, of leaking non-public information. And that's, you know, it's just a ridiculous situation that I don't think if the average person knew exactly how this place operated, they would find it rational in the least. I mean, if a congressman or a senator can propose legislation, publish it on the website, and have an open debate about it, I don't see why we can't do the same thing either. We should be at least as open and transparent as Congress.
Well, and especially now when, you know, I think at the inception, the FCC was sort of wasn't a very public agency in that it was supposed to be an expert agency in which, you know, the engineers and the economists got together and figured out regulations on things that the public wouldn't even begin to understand, even if they had an interest in them. But nowadays, it's sort of like regulation by polling. I mean, it's like if 4 million bot comments are filed with the FCC on an issue, well, it must be good. So,
Right. Well, and also we've seen in the set-top box proceeding the fact that there's no substitute for publishing the text of an order. I mean, mm-hmm. this is a classic case where the chairman said, look, this is what my proposal, this is what my order would do. And Commissioner O'Reilly and I said, no, we can tell you, we've read this thing. This is exactly what it says in paragraphs 53 and 54 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he would say, no, you're wrong. And we would say, no, we're right. And sort of like this, like kind of debate my five-year-old and three-year-old would have. Mm-hmm. I said, look, don't take my word for it. Just publish the text and everyone can make up his or her own mind. I mean, that's the way it should work. But yeah, unfortunately, we're one vote short of making that process reform a reality.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trust me, I know what I'm doing. It doesn't work if it hasn't worked well in the past.
Yeah.
So what do you see on the horizon for the FCC next year after, we have a new president and presumably a new chairman? Are there big issues that you wanted to get to that you haven't been able to address in your tenure so far?
Oh, absolutely. And that's one of the reasons why I've been speaking about broadband deployment in particular. That's an area where I think we can work together in ways that we haven't over the past couple of years. And a few weeks ago in Cincinnati, I laid out in a speech some ideas for broadband deployment, some of which lie beyond the FCC's power to enact, but nonetheless, I think would go a long way in making sure that internet access is as ubiquitous as the telephone service of old. And so getting rid of some of the regulatory barriers to installing fiber, making sure that the rules for deploying wireless infrastructure are streamlined, trying to make sure that our spectrum policy is as forward-thinking as it can be to enable a 5G future. And on the entrepreneurship side, boosting the availability of crowdfunding and other finance vehicles for startups and making sure we don't try to fit startups into old legacy models, sort of the Uber, Airbnb problem. I really think in every one of the proposals in there, which your listeners can find on the FCC.gov website, every one of them is designed to be a bipartisan solution that we can all rally around. And so regardless of who the next president is, who the next FCC chairman is, who controls Congress or the Senate, this is something that I hope, and I designed it to be something that we could all work together on in 2017 and beyond. I remain hopeful that we can get moving on that next year.
You're always the optimist.
might be the foolish Kansan in me, but thanks.
just to be clear, the broadband deployment plans that you have is not simply for rural broadband. This is across the board.
Absolutely. One of the core proposals I outlined was for what I called gigabit opportunity zones or GOZs. And the idea here was if you have an area as small as a neighborhood or as large as a county where the median income is only 75% of the national median, then in those areas, we would give federal tax incentives to internet service providers to deploy gigabit services. We would encourage states and local governments to streamline the regulations to do essentially what Kansas City did for Google Fiber to enable them to deploy. We would also provide some incentives to startups in order to build new businesses in those areas to promote job creation and economic growth. And from the folks I've spoken to thus far, from minority advocates to rural entrepreneurs, this is something they would really long for because they want to be able to create jobs and have this tech presence somewhere outside of Silicon Valley or New York City. And this would be a way of allowing them to do that. And so the gigabit opportunity zones in particular are something that, I hope will find some favor in 2017, regardless of political affiliation.
We're going to have to start moving innovation zones outside of Silicon Valley just because the housing prices are so ridiculous in Silicon Valley that that's actually a big bottleneck on what the startups and even the big established companies, especially them, because they can't lure people with stock options quite as readily.
Well, I often wonder, I was telling my wife this too, I mean, if you work at the post office, if you're a teacher, I mean, how on earth do you live in a place like Palo Alto and make the ends meet? My gosh, it's going to be really expensive.
Hour and a half commute.
Yeah. Yeah. You have to live really far away from the place you're serving.
Yeah. So. And, school starts at like 6:30 in the morning. So, I mean, it's farmer's hours. I guess you get up before the sunrise and feed your chickens.
If I'm ever elected president, that's going to be the first part of my platform is trying to find a consensus on moving the start date for school further up. I was never a morning person never having to go to school at 6 a.m. That was killer.
I always tried to get a first period class. It was something I didn't care about because It is. I think it's good for learning languages, though, those early, because your brain is kind of malleable, and that's maybe the one thing. But 6:30, I mean, come on.
Oh. Well, in those days, I hadn't discovered coffee either, so I was just sort of bleary-eyed for the rest of the day. So, was
brutal. Yeah, well, great. I think that pretty well wraps up our time. I know you've got other obligations today, and instead of sitting around talking to me all day long.
Pleasure.
Thanks a lot for joining us on the High Tech Forum podcast, and I hope we'll do it again sometime.
No, I hope so. I've loved chatting with you. I really appreciate the work you do and on the blog and elsewhere. And yeah, let's keep the conversation going.
We will. Okay, folks, this wraps up this edition of the High Tech Forum podcast. If you liked what you heard, you go to iTunes and give us a recommendation. We do these podcasts about every 2 weeks, and they're accompanied by a blog post where you can comment on our website, hightechforum.org. And I'm Richard Bennett, signing off.